Hi, this is Terry Kuzma from Penn State University, and I'd like to present part two of Microfluidics, a review with selected biological applications. So this is our presentation to do today, and it's a continuation from part one. And what we did last time is we actually overviewed these different sections that occur here in black. So we went over microfluidics overview, why it's important. It's a growing field, emerging field, important field for biotechnology, and for a bunch of different types of tests. Then we looked at the basic physics of microfluidics to really, what I intended this to do is to show some of the issues with microfluidics, like, there's the general rule of thumb, there's laminar flow and materials don't mix. And I guess the assumption could be made that we actually want to have mixing occur so that we can have a reaction. So then we had to overcome those hurdles and look at those issues. And then, like any other device, we had to look at some operational components. You know, how we would do the mixing, how we would do filtration, and how we would do other operational issues. So we looked at those basic components. And what that brings us to now is an overview of materials and applications. And this is a relatively short section, because I guess you could talk for days and days literally on materials and applications for microfluidics. But we're going to highlight some things that would help us review these issues and provide a nice overview. So common materials that we would like to use for microfluidics, probably one of the nicer materials that we could use is silicon dioxide. So silicon dioxide, SiO2, it's easy to etch. And it's easy to layering. So we can actually build units out of this. And it's a common material, certainly very, very popular in microelectronics. And I always say for people ask me, you know, why is silicon king in microelectronics? And that's really because silicon dioxide is queen. So it's a well-understood material, a tremendous amount of money because, you know, it goes hand-in-hand with silicon for the microelectronics market. And I'm told it's one of the most researched materials in the world, silicon dioxide, quartz, etc. So it's a well-understood material, relatively cheap. And I guess for like if we're looking at specifically or looking towards biological applications, they always say, you know, in vivo in the body and in vitro in the glass. So this is the glass, so it's naturally a nice system to work with a lot of biological materials, if that's a goal, and certainly a goal of mine. Metals, it's easy to do additive and subtractive process, kind of relatively inexpensive to do as far as the materials, but maybe the machinery is expensive to get a hold of. And then there's just some pictures right here, microfluidics, for your view. Other materials that are common are polymers. And, you know, certainly what's important about polymers and a lot of what we look at or deal with on a day-to-day basis are polymers and plastics. They're relatively inexpensive. They're easy to shape, and they might easy for our application. They might do something because they're lower melting temperatures. We might be able to do something like emboss them. So we might be able to literally stamp these things out for, microfluidic devices. And then certainly something that's been used for a long time for microfluidics or, scientific analysis is paper. And papers, in the world of microfluidics, it's certainly now an emerging technology, because it's so inexpensive. And now that we have a lot of the technologies from the semiconductor market, such as thermal evaporation, lithography processes, etc., it's a very popular because now we could make, you know, on average, just to say like a automobile might be $30,000 when you go to buy the average automobile in the United States. But on average, if you were to buy a microfluidic device and it was made out of paper, it certainly would be less than lunch at McDonald's. So it's a rather cheap material to use. So that's why we're interested in it. And it actually offers a lot of utility. One of the things that it offers is utility paper, just like paper towels. It can wick, and it has capillary action to move the fluids around. And as we reviewed in part one of this presentation, it was often difficult to move fluids because of the physics at that small scale. So paper comes along with this ability to have this wicking ability. So it overcomes a lot of those problems. And again, it's inexpensive, we can use lower processing temperatures to do different deposition work, like metal deposition, etc. And we can also stain the paper with some kind of reactant to have a reaction occur. So it's pretty nice. So again, like a review to go over this stuff in case I miss something, I put this slide in there. So silicon dioxide, really efficient material, well-studied, inexpensive, easy to obtain. As far as a substrate, we can provide a substrate made out of silicon. So then that silicon substrate could be on the assembly line. All the machinery is built for silicon wafers. So cluster tools, etc., etch tools, deposition tools, they're all built around that platform where the robots can handle that type of material. So we can take a silicon wafer and basically put it into a high temperature oxygen furnace and then put a layer of silicon dioxide on the top of it. So we can use the silicon substrate, you know, mechanically, and then on top we can grow an oxide or deposit an oxide in many various ways. We can also, once we have that oxide, we can plasma etch that. So by using plasma etching, plasma etching can be really well controlled, super repeatable, and we can change the geometries of the etch profile that we're creating in the silicon dioxide. So that's really, really important. So it comes with something that's, again, borrowed from the microelectronics industry, plasma etching, well understood, highly accurate, highly repeatable, and done in an assembly line. It could be looked at as when we are handing silicon dioxide, the machinery is expensive, and perhaps some of the chemistry is dangerous. So probably if we were doing chemical etching and wet etching, we would use my good friend hydrofluoric acid. And certainly from our discussions in ESI 211, we know that that is a very dangerous chemical, and certainly dangerous to an individual, but it's also difficult on the environment, difficult to store. EPA regulations, you have to worry about things like that because it is so dangerous. So it comes with a lot of expense, I guess, you know, expense to the environment, potential expense that you might have issues with it if there's a spill, etc. So, but it's a very nice material. Certainly, like I said, one of the most researched materials on the planet, and certainly something that the average American pays a lot of money for every year in the form of the parts in their cell phones and cars, etc. So it's a well-understood common material. So metals themselves, when we're looking at metals, we could use this for all kind of different things. Sometimes the metals can get expensive. One metal that we might want to use in nanotechnology often is gold. And gold itself, we know, is expensive. We might use that as gold nanoparticles. It's a nice material because one of the issues that we might want to look at is when we build a substrate, we might want to place a gold pattern on here. And then from that area, if we were looking at biological applications, we might want to use this as a point where we're going to examine a biological entity, the gold. What we can do from that point, none of this is the scale, but we can do a sulfur part on there and then this polymer tail made out of C's and H's. And what this will provide us is a selected area to do our work, this gold template. And then what we can do there, we can tether biological material there because now we have this sulfur head with a polymer tail. And then on the end of that, we might potentially do something like tether a protein or DNA or something like that. So this is a nice system that it'll give us this ability to actually place and form like our lab on a chip, if you want to call it that. So this is a nice algorithm that we would do. And these are specific materials, but gold tends to be non-reactive. It's a noble metal and it comes with this nice association that Stauffer likes to stick to it rather well. So on a nanoscale, we can, purchase these things like at Sigma Aldrich, a thiol, which is a sulfur head with a polymer tail. And then from there, what we can do is we can link some, you know, biological entity to that and do our work from there. So that's a nice algorithm to do. And for expensive materials, I would certainly identify like gold is that. But we could use other materials. We could use in place of gold, we could use silver. And then this link would be like carbolic acid or something. So there's a list of metals that you could use that actually have like a self-assembled material that would like to stick to them. And then from there, what we could do is tether some kind of experimental material. So that's really nice. And again, it's well understood. I guess you can view it as expensive. But certainly we can include metal depositions on a paper microfluidic substrate, and it still would be under, you know, the price of a Happy Meal at McDonald's to test for some type of pollutant or something. And then certainly polymers, very inexpensive. They can be patterned, they can be bolded, they can be embossed. They're real easy to mass produce. And certainly they're used quite a bit and again, well understood. So, you know, one of the highlights, I guess, of microfluidics, while the applications are unique and far ranging, really the materials have a heritage associated with them and certainly an understanding that we could be able to grasp what they're going to do and predict what they're due and be able to access their properties because they're so widely available and the systems are available. So paper, certainly it's an active or passive result. What we can do is we can do something like we can do a stain and have the paper change color like a litmus paper, or we could do something, use it as a substrate and maybe measure current or voltage on a fluid as we change the fluid in some way. So it's certainly inexpensive, real easy to use. But it's generally slow. If you would look at the average reaction rate on a paper microfluidic chip compared to a conventional one, which might be built on silicon dioxide with a PDMS top that's transparent to carry the fluid, that might be the three-dimensional part, they generally tend to be a little bit slower in their reactions just because of the capillary action. So there might be a moderate amount of trade-off in that area. But it's certainly acceptable. And you know, personally, if I had to do work on microfluidics, which I'm doing on the side here at the university, I kind of prefer paper. It just seems like that's built well for society, you know, that it's inexpensive, easy to obtain, easy to transfer. So I think it's a really nice platform to work with. So these things are all, I guess, standards and norms. None of this is unusual or far-reaching. This is where the bar is for microfluidics as far as materials. These are all very common. So again, let's look at some common polymer materials and zero in on this. Some materials that are favorites all the time for nanotechnology and material processing, if you would do research and look at papers, these words come up quite often and they're studied in the program and other courses. But we have a nice material here, PMMA. And what PMMA is, it's like an epoxy. So it's the material that they would use to bind wood together to make wood products. So they use that in wood binders. It's commonly like super glue to build a model or something like that. So it's a hard, rigid glue like an epoxy. There's PDMS. And PDMS, I guess people are familiar with, it's basically silicone. So it's the stuff that you would use to seal a bathtub. It's the material that you would use to make a contact lens. So if we would examine, you know, PDMS or review PDMS, what it is a PDMS is a contact lens. So it's certainly biocompatible with the eye, so it doesn't cause infections, etc. It's oxygen permeable. And what's really nice about it can be made hydrophobic or hydrophilic simply by inserting it for a short amount of time in a low-energy ozone plasma. So 15 seconds in an ozone plasma will change its properties, and we can change the hydrophobicity of that material. So that's really, really handy for that. And PDMS, just like PMMA, is relatively inexpensive. I think there's all kind of different forms that you could buy PDMS. But if we were to buy a liquid PDMS and something from Sigmund Aldridge or whatever, then maybe a quart would run $35 or $40 or $50, depending on the viscosity and where you buy it, etc. But for a quart, it's relatively inexpensive. And as a contact lens, they might be a dollar a piece. a contact lens being a dollar a piece, I guess a drop in some ways, or a drop or two would make a contact lens. So after you make 35 or 50 contact lenses, the quart is paid for, and you still have a lot left in the quart. Once you, you know, take 100 drops out of there, there's still a lot of material left in there. So it's certainly an economically viable material, and it has a lot of attributes. You know, it's the MSDS is relatively benign in all its activities, except for the solvent that's in there. So after it's dried, it's really nice to use. Polyamides are like thermosets. So they've used these for a long time for like insulators for the electronic market, like telephone poles in old time days. And polyamides could be considered materials if you're familiar with things like bakelite. So they would cast entities in here, maybe like a vase or something like that. I know it was popular back in the early 1900s for firearms that the stocks on maybe a pistol would be cast out of a polyamide in some kind of mold, and then it would say Colt on the side or whatever. So that's where polyamides come in for into being and usefulness. And the reason they did, it was inexpensive to do. So we're going to do that same thing, be able to cast things inexpensively into polyamides. And then there's SU8, which is a photoresist, but I guess kind of an unusual photoresist, because normally we'd look at SU8 or photoresist as a purely sacrificial layer. So we would use it, define a pattern, and then we would remove the SU8 because it's kind of like a temporary material. But actually SU8 is kind of getting around to being like a polyamide, that it has a lot of mechanical integrity. So you might just own SU8, not just as a photoresist, but as a cast material. So certainly you would, or engineers take advantage of the ability to pattern it with light and to control it or cure it or make a pattern with that. But then after that point, it might be sold as a product. So for example, we might be able to do something like get a mask, pattern SU8 on a substrate. And once it's patterned, we would dry cure it and it's mechanically stable. Then we could put that in like a little box or something and pour PDMS on top. And then we could make an image of that SU8 pattern and then peel the PDMS off. So we could kind of make something like a stamp, or commonly like these systems right here. This might be PDMS, and where this pattern came from that you can see in this diagram was on, I'll propose that it might be on SU8, and then somebody simply poured the PDMS over top of here, dry cured it, and then peeled it off. And then this was kind of like, I guess the mechanically active part, because it would be the three-dimensional part of the microfluidic device, where we would actually flow liquids or gases through there. So that's nice. And then generally the rule of thumb, maybe the bottom might be a rigid piece of SiO2, and we might do things like deposit metal on there. So that would be more of a two-dimensional substrate, use my imagination a little bit. So that would be a relatively flat planar issue where we would carry out maybe some electronics function or a tether DNA. And then the PDMS cap would go on top, and that would be the three-dimensional part of the chip where the fluids would actually be able to flow. So if you would look at those two issues, the bottom being made out of silicon, maybe with a silicon dioxide cap on there, or maybe the bottom is just directly made out of a quartz substrate, that's relatively inexpensive. And then we identified, the PDMS for contact lenses, that, you know, a contact lens might cost, again, you know, a buck or two. So when you put those things together, even this system might turn out to be relatively inexpensive, at least on the first iteration to manufacture from a back of envelope kind of look at that kind of stuff. So these are nice pictures here that show some applications for MEMS and what we might want to do with them. High aspect ratios here cast in SU8. And again, the dimensions here I think are important. So if we're looking at, you know, if somebody walks up to me and says microfluidics, you know, I think a base number might be 100 microns which happens to be kind of like, you know, a nice easy number, but maybe that's the thickness of a hair. So maybe, you know, microfluidic device might have 500 micron channels. So it's, you know, it's an order of magnitude within a hair or something like that. So, you know, the diameter of a few hairs, and certainly this is a tenth of that. So as we get larger, for 50 microns is difficult to flow through fluids through. They don't like to mix at that level because of the Reynolds number. But when we go at higher geometries or make things a little bit bigger, then they become they're able to mix a little bit more efficiently. So maybe it lends itself to say whether I'd select as an average number for microfluidics if I'm going to make dimensions that are 50 microns or 500. Now, you have to certainly look at the application, but the rule of thumb is you'd probably be more comfortable with design on the 500 micron scale. So that's nice because the microelectronics market, per se, deals quite often in sub-micron numbers. So now we're using that same type of technology in assembly line, and we're doing things that might be on the order of 500 microns. So really, we're using we have the ability to use really high precision technology and tools to do dimensions that are relatively large. So the ability to make, as designed, to be able to carry out the process and to make microfluidics and actually carry out that process as designed, is kind of easy to do in some ways because of the relative scale. So I think it's really difficult to make things that are very, very submicron, which are done all the time, you know, certainly in your cell phone. Those things are complete and your cell phone works. But now we're asking technology to do something that's tremendously a lot easier because of the scale. So that's really nice to take a look at those scales from those pictures and show what we're looking at. So, you know, PDMS, discussed before, we took a look at this. It's basically the material that they make contact lenses out of it. So it's non-toxic, naturally it's optically transparent. And what's nice about optically transparent, if I did want to make it, opaque, I guess I could in some ways, not by just changing the properties of PDMS, but if I wanted to block a section of a microfluidic device from light or a laser, et cetera, what I could do is I can always deposit aluminum or something on top of the PDMS. So using that as a substrate, we have both conditions where we can see through it optically, and then it has the ability with other materials to make it opaque. We could actually cast aluminum or deposit aluminum over top of that and then make it not transparent. And the surface is easily modified, so it's naturally hydrophobic. But if we would put it in an oxygen plasma, we would make it hydrophilic. And then from that point, you know, a classic test would be to measure the wetting angle on the water droplet. So as we have more bonds on the surface, so if I would draw a surface relatively here, if I looked at the surface like this, and if I had a couple bonds sticking out here, if I put a water droplet on there, that water droplet being polar, it'll go to those bonds like this. But if we had another surface, and if I had a lot of bonds on there, if I change the material properties of the PDMS, and I have a lot of bonds that are sticking out of there, when I put that water droplet on there, boy, it's going to spread out, because there's more energy drawing that polar water down. So that's what's shown in here. This is a hydrophilic because it likes water, because there's a lot of bonds available. So what it's going to do is spread out the water. And then this example right here is hydrophobic. In its natural state, it's hydrophobic. It doesn't have that many bonds to offer. So when we put a water droplet on there, it won't wet it very well. It'll stick up. And so then you could say that's a low energy system. And again, if we would take a look, or certainly biology guys that are interested in biomaterials, probably some of the first things that they would look at for a biomaterial is it wettable or non-wettable? So they like to think in realms of, if I wanted to have cell adhesion to either one of these materials, material A or material B, what if the cell wanted to adhere, generally I would have to have the water come down and adhere, and then I would have proteins adhere, and then the cells could see the proteins, and then from that area they would adhere. So for cellular growth, if I wanted to do something like grow bone cells in a dish in vitro, right, this would be the thing that I would be looking at. This wouldn't grow bone cells that way well. So these are things that are, you know, the bio guys would look at is, you know, this, the ability of PDMS to be universal to them. They could actually make it have cellular growth or not have cellular growth and predictable by the bond energy that's available on the surface. So it's useful for fluid flow and surface bonding. Once we would put this into oxygen plasma like this, what we can do is take that piece of PDMS, and it looks like a postage stamp, and we can flip it over and stick it on a piece of silicon dioxide, a rigid substrate. That these bonds that are available, what they're going to do is they act like glue. And we're going to stick to that silicon dioxide substrate like nobody's business. And you would probably peel, destroy the PDMS before you had the ability to peel that off the surface. So for microfluidics, I mean, one of the things we might want to just, you know, expand upon, we probably want to have a material that looks like this, you know, a solid rigid material made out of PDMS. And then it has these channels in here. And then these three-dimensional channels, this is where we're going to do the fluid flow in this area. Then what we're going to have is a solid material down here. And if we would put glue on here, I mean, just for, you know, our imagination, if we would put some kind of glue, whoop, can't even spell the word glue. But if we would put the word, if we would glue on here, you know, according to Murphy's Law, the glue would go in the channel. So it's kind of magic that we can place this material that's hydrophobic or hydrophilic or create the, or change the hydrophobicity of this material. And when we make it really hydrophilic, we have the bonds on the surface like this. Those bonds can go on here and then stick to this material well. So we can actually glue it together without glue. And you know, if we had glue on there, it would wind up in these channels and clog the channels. So that's a pretty nice feature. And really what makes PDMS important is this ability to make its own, I guess, I don't know if you want to call it a virtual glue or whatever, that we're going to elicit these bonds here below and have the ability to stick the things that have bonds on the surface like this. So it's a really nice feature. So certainly biocompatible because we can predict its hydrophobicity. So we would be able to say, you know, with some certainty what would happen in the world of bio because now we can look at its hydrophobicity, ability to wet, ability to have protein adhesion, and ability to elicit cellular growth. So again, a review of the common polymer materials. We have PMMA. It's a thermoplastic used for molding and light. And again, this stuff, we can think of this as like glue, airplane glue to put models together. And it's also the thing that they would use to bind wood together to make plywood. So that's PMMA. PDMS is the things that they make contact, or the material that people make contact lenses out of. It's non-toxic, optically transparent, and it can be cured rather easily. So it comes as a liquid, and then you cure it at room temperature and at a slightly elevated temperature, like a cup of coffee, and it'll cure between 24 hours and 1 hour. And then polyamides, we talked about these before. They might be things like Bakelite. They are easy castable material. They tend to be brittle. So, if you would look at old insulators on, telephone poles, et cetera, something that would be like a plastic ceramic kind of material. That's what, these things tend to be. So a cast. So they remind me of like a ceramic and these would be used again, like I said, the turn of the century, they would make, in the 1900s, they would make cast like stocks on the side of firearms, like a Colt pistol or something like that. So they'd have the horse on there that represents the Colt Corporation. And they would also put in their little diamonds so that it would adhere to your hand rather well. So it was a nice inexpensive way instead of using wood for that application or whatever, they could just cast these. and they were good enough, so they were inexpensive, and they have the ability to be cast, so it's a good example. And then SU-8, typically used as a photoresist most of the time, but we could also use it as an actual product because it has high mechanical strength, and we can get high aspect ratios, and it generally comes as a negative photoresist. So we have a lot of skill from ESI 214 tricks and algorithms that we were able to process photoresist. So we can use all those things in our with a material that's very popular in microfluidics, SU-8. And this is just a chart that would show you the companies and the approximate cost, which I think is kind of important. So we said like PDMS, you know, by the quart, maybe $40 or $50 or something like that. SU-8, boy, you know, 2.2 pounds a kilogram, $500, quite a bit more expensive than PDMS. And then PMMA, being that it's like an epoxy glue kind of stuff, really inexpensive, $2, $3 a kilogram. And then the polyamides, well, they get to be expensive here. They're thousands of dollars per kilogram. And again, these are approximate costs, but just to give us a scale. And even at this rate, because kilograms, 2.2 pounds, we're going to use very little of these materials in a microfluidic device. So at least in my viewpoint, a typical microfluidic device might be as big as a postage stamp. And then the amount of material that we'd use on there is fairly negligible. So even at this amount of money, we'd certainly be able to make microfluidic devices as big as a postage stamp, relatively inexpensive. So this just tells you, if you wanted to do some more research, some of the primary manufacturers where you could find these things, brand name, etc., you know, Silgard, Dow Corning, you know, very popular materials. And you could look these up online if you had any further need to get some more details about these. So when we integrate the parts together, so, you know, this slide, now it comes time to start to discuss, you know, how are we going to build a device, you know, and how are we going to make it work? And naturally, we want to have the liquid flow. So a lot of times what we would need in a conventional device, which might be expressed like this, that we had a three-dimensional piece up here that we might have channels cast into it, such as PDMS. And then we have a two-dimensional thing down here that might have like a metal portion on here, etc., might have wires running on or something. So this top part might be thought of as like a 3D portion of the microfluidic device, and this being relatively flat might be a 2D portion of the device. And we would place this in an oxygen plasma, bring these into contact, and then we would have a system that we could use. So at that point, what we're going to do is now we need to run some kind of fluid through here, so we need to push it. We also need to control where this fluid goes, so we're going to have to valve the liquid. So we might do something like have a standard material, like a material from a patient or some material from a stream that we want to test, and we're going to have to steer that towards where we want to have a reaction. And at that point, we're going to have to add a reactant to it and then examine the reaction, I guess, in a typical scenario. So valves are certainly necessary. And then what we expect, because of our previous study in part one, is at the micron scale in that area, and the things, you know, channels that are typically, you know, on the order of, you know, microns in some fashion, these channels really don't mix well. So what we're going to have to do is probably provide some kind of mixer and stir. And typically what we would look at is a mixer and stir. And I guess I cook a lot, so I look at things in the kitchen, you know, like some kind of stirring thing or mixer to make a cake or to some kind of thing to like stir up fruits to make a smoothie or something like that. That's not what we're going to do. We're not really going to have a mechanical system that looks like a motor on the back of a boat, excuse me, to mix things up. What we're probably going to do, a really good mixer, is just jagged lines in this three-dimensional flow, and they actually go at different speeds, etc., around these bends, and that's going to cause turbulence. So if somebody walked up to me and said, microfluidic mixer, I'm going to have something in my mind that reminds me of something that looks like that, because it's easy to make. There's no moving parts, et cetera, and it gets the job done. So that might be probably the most popular mixer that we can have. And then these devices listed here are made from the materials that we reviewed in some fashion. So we want to take a look at that. So here's an example of a nice system. It's a pulsed amperometric detection system. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to put a place of material in the microfluidic device. And at that point in the microfluidic device, we're going to do two things. We're going to change the test solution by applying a bias. So by applying a bias to there, some current, pulsed current. So this represents the pulse current. What we're going to do is we ionize or change the conductivity of the material. That amount of conductivity, then we're going to measure the material and measure the conductivity. The conductivity change is going to be representative of what the material was. So what we can do is we can use this as like a detective. So we can take an unknown material or suspected material and say that it has its water with arsenic in there, for example. What we can do is we would place that inside this system. We would apply some kind of current to the test material, and then we would measure the conductivity of the fluid. So if that fluid would have arsenic in it or amino acids, then that conductivity is going to be specific. It'll be a specific change that we can see in there. So we're going to use that conductivity as a clue to determine what materials that are there. And again, if we can look from this title of this paper here, we can determine carbohydrates, amino acids, antibiotics, and other things. And they also use this type of technology, exact type of technology. In fact, these same researchers use that type of technology to examine typical pollutants that are in streams, et cetera, or food streams. So you might want to examine, you know, you could potentially use this and take samples of areas where they're processing food materials. And then we can determine if there's things in the food materials that aren't appropriate. So these electrical chemical detectors, so we would, you know, simplify this word to a pad. This establishes electrochemical liquid detector technology. This pad is based on measurement of current resulting from oxidation or reduction reaction in the analyte at a suitable electrode. So in that portion, what we might do is we might examine the material that we're testing just as a material, or we might add another material, a valve of material in there, and have it react with some other purposeful material that we put in there. So we would take the unknown material and a material that we know, and when we place them in intimate contact, then we're going to have a predictable reaction, which we might be able to measure electrically. So since the level of the current is directly proportional to the analyte concentration, the detector could be used for quantification. And that's really important. This type of, I'm going to go back a page. This type of system, what we're doing is we're going to put a meter on here. And this meter, when we go to measure, it's going to give us a specific number. And that's a quantified, you know, we're going to take that over and connect that here. That number is going to tell us, you know, a quantitative value. A lot of times in the past, maybe microfluidic devices, like early pregnancy tests, et cetera, they would have a visual response. So the material might turn from pink to blue or something like that. And then we would know that we have a go or no-go situation, which is rather qualitative understanding of what happened in the reaction. But with this type of reaction, we're actually doing a measurement. So we could get the amount of amino acids, the amount of carbohydrates, or the amount of antibiotics that were in a system. So that's really a step up, that this will give us a quantifiable number. What this does is it takes the pressure off of a technician. If we had a reaction take place and say there was a color change, it's relatively ambiguous what that color change would mean. So you would need a trained person to look at that, and certainly you would need some kind of standard to compare that to. That might not be that difficult today with cell phones, et cetera, and the ability to import and use that as like a mini computer and standardize colors, et cetera. But this is a pretty nice system. Being an engineer, I always like numbers. So I like that that's a quantifiable number on there. So that's what this is going to be do. So it can be used for all kind of things, looking at these types of materials. And this isn't in per se research. This is in use. So this isn't an ideal or an idea that's going to be might happen. This is actually a useful device that's currently marketed. So this just tells you that, again, you can feel free to read this, but this is going to tell you that we're going to use, we're going to look at these different types of materials, use a gold wire as an electrode. And gold's nice because we can do things like deposit gold at relatively low temperatures with simple machines like a thermal evaporator. So moderately low melting temperature of gold, we can do thermal evaporation. We can also sputter it down. And the only, I guess, the detractor there, obviously, is gold's moderately expensive. But the amount of gold we would use on a microfluidic device is rather negligible. So it's really used. And then I think this is really important, and you're certainly free to look up this paper, get on Google Scholar or something and pull this paper up. It's a nice paper. They're saying that they have detection limits in the femtomole range. So that's really, really important. So this could be used for all types of monitoring. And again, this algorithm or mindset that we're going to actually take in a material, apply some kind of energy, change the material, and then look at how the material changed in some fashion will give us a determination. That's a really powerful algorithm to use. So we're going to take a look at this. These researchers like Charles Henry out at Colorado, he actually applied this. This was some initial work that he did in 2003. He later took the same type of technology, identical technology or identical algorithm, and he transferred this to paper. So he did the same work with this and has used the same algorithm, but now they're able to issue these test systems a lot less expensively. So he made it a lot cheaper. So certainly a good algorithm, and then applied to the world of paper microfluidics. And this is how it's done. They would apply to the terminals. They do a cleaning bias, and then they would activate a reactivation bias. And then what they'll do with another set of the probes that are on that device, they'll actually do a measurement at that point at those voltages. And so then this tells you the detection time and scale. And I thought it was important, I just offer this slide later on, if I remember when I'm doing the presentation. This took less than a second to get a result. And when we look at the same paper device, it took quite a bit more time. But it didn't take days, but it took seconds. So this one was on the scale a lot quicker, but I don't know if that matters that much because they're both relatively quick. But I looked at a bunch of different papers or researched different papers and devices. And one common theme that I saw was, for the most part, conventional microfluidics that had like a PDMS top and a silicon dioxide base, et cetera. This might be considered, a normal number to read. And when we would look at the same type of system built with paper microfluidics, it took longer for the average determination for that system to work. So that was just something that I picked up when I was doing some research in this area. So here's another system. And this was done by some researchers down in, I think, the University of Austin in Texas. And what this is, I thought this was nice because we talked about things in microfluidics that we would want to use a pump and mixer, stirrers, et cetera. And to get work done, you need energy, right? And one form of energy that you might want to use or consider just as an engineer all the time is heat. So there's such a thing called a thermosiphon system or thermocycler. And basically what that is, you know, heated fluids rise and cold fluids sink. And I know from my personal experience, you know, I had a 1950s Farmall tractor, and it was a relatively big tractor, you know, a small farm tractor. I think back in the day they used for those for cultivating. I got a few acres and I used it to cut grass on my property. I have like a little pasture there, so I used that to cut grass. But it was around 20 horsepower. And at that level, it didn't really have that much energy or that much heat dissipation that it needed a water pump. So it had a radiator on there, but basically it was just an open radiator, and there was a connection on the top of the motor and a connection on the bottom of the motor. And just from thermocycling, what it would do is take the water heated up through the engine that would rise, and it would push the fluid around. So it was a pump, but it really didn't have any moving parts. So the same type of technology taken from, not literally taken from 1950 tractors, but that's how I saw it initially, because I was wondering where the water pump was on my tractor. And so somebody explained that just works on, heat rising and cold sinking. So that same type of technology, that use of energy, is used here. So that's nice because it's a way to move fluids around. And what this gentleman did, Victor, what he did is he used this to make a system that actually moves fluid around and moves fluid at different temperatures. And in that guise, what he used this to do is monitor or control the polymerase chain reaction. So I thought that this was brilliant because I'm interested in things like DNA replication, etc. And, because of the tractor issue of my own, personal past and all that other stuff, I just thought that it was brilliant. It was kind of really neat to see what this guy did. And again, I guess our goal with microfluidics is to make, medical devices, testing devices more accessible and cheaper to the general population. That's what this, gentleman did. So he built a battery powered, system. And that's reusable at a cost of around $10. And then what he does is he puts the DNA juice in there, we'll call it. He puts that in something that represents a small straw. So you take some small tubing, inserts the DNA material, and then mounts it to this reusable $10 device. And then he's able to move the fluid around there by heat. And at those portions, while it's moving around, while the fluid's been moved around by the thermo motion, it also can be controlled at that level. So that's where the PCR chain reaction takes place. So I really thought that this was so simple and eloquent. So I thought that it was nice to report on this in my presentation. So I just, I like it when engineers are pretty sly. So this was what it looks like. So he made this unit. And again, this is pretty nice because in places that don't have an infrastructure or hospital, and that could be, who knows, New York City, or that could be, Miami or whatever. If there's a storm or some kind of event, maybe the infrastructure is not there. Power is down, et cetera. So this is a remote system using rechargeable batteries here with a simple board. And basically what he does is he mounts this. This is the control board. This is the PCR chain reaction heater block. And on here, what he has is this area here. This is the tubing. So it kind of resembles a small straw. And that part is disposable. And like a PDMS straw, like a catheter tubing, etc. For something that's on a scale of a few inches like this, I don't think that costs pennies to make. And so what he does is inserts the fluid in there, puts it onto the device, and then this device is going to control the temperature and the flow rate that he's moving the fluid around, and he's able to get the PCR reaction to take place. So I guess it's a common theme, and we examine it in the course, in other courses within the ESIDE 211 to 216 gambit. We look at how we do this heating and what happens at this place. So There's a denaturing of the DNA material, the annealing of the DNA material, and then the extension of the DNA material. And again, this is 2 centimeters, so that's around an inch. That's how big this device is, or you can see the scaling on there, and you can see the scaling with the battery. So these are AA batteries. And basically what he does is he connected this disposable tubing right here to this network, and this is a schematic drawing, and I thought this was, like, again, really brilliant. What he did is he has one resistor in this area where it's the hottest. So he heats that up with that controller to 95 degrees. And then he controls the heat transfer to other regions within the device. He controls that heat transfer by these little metal studs. So by adjusting these in and out, he can actually control the amount of heat that these are able to transfer. So if the conditions change, your battery got weaker, etc., or this wasn't made to tolerance, the tolerances can float on this device, what you're able to do is fine-tune it by these screws. And these screws would represent heat transfer. So I thought it was really brilliant because, you know, this gentleman used all that he had. So he used one resistor. Minimize the components, minimize the cost, use this simple mechanical transfer to transfer the heat to here, and then control the heat transfer from this section to this section here. At the same time, the heat is actually going to flow in this direction, right? So again, simple and eloquent. So I thought that was beautiful. And, you know, we wanted to get work done. We wanted to move fluid. So certainly the answer is, apply energy. This gentleman selected heat. Then he took that heat and then really sly put it into this system. So I thought that was really, really cool to do that. This paper has been quoted a tremendous amount of time and used quite a bit. So again, to look at our maybe perceived goal of this presentation, how can we make microfluidics, you know, inexpensive, more accessible, to the general population? And what we can do is we can actually take the substrate, and instead of using a moderate cost substrate like silicon or quartz and PDMS, we can use paper, which is really, really inexpensive. And paper comes at the advantage of having that wicking action. So if we look at the history of paper, and people have been using paper for thousands of years to do tests, etc., and litmus papers and all that other stuff. But really the first modern use of paper really geared towards scientific research in some big way, or microfluidics under some umbrella idea, really took place, I think, rather recently, you know, in the 1980s. So this stuff isn't per se that old, but it's certainly taking off at a high rate. So if you would examine like scientific journals and see the amount of work that's been done with paper substrate in recent years, you know, certainly there's an exponential rise in research that's been done. And a lot of that is what they're doing is using older technology from the silicon PDMS world of microfluidics and applying those tests to the world of paper, making it cheaper. So here's some of the recent work that was done. You know, in 1988, immunoassays were done. So this is probably one of the most famous and universally accepted use of microfluidics and devices is the home pregnancy test. So certainly accessible on every, you know, CVS and Walmart in the country. And then there's another one, a laminated assay device for detection of cholesterol using hydrophobic printing on and cutting on paper. So that was done in the 1990s. And I thought it was interesting. I don't know if I have this in I'll remember to talk about it in a presentation later on. Sometimes what they'll do is they'll take paper as a substrate. They define the channels by area where the paper exists. And then where they don't want channels exist, what they'll do is they'll apply a wax. And then that wax clogs the pores of the paper up. They do an anneal in that area, and then that area is, for the most part, forbidden for fluidic flow because it's clogged up with the wax. So then the areas that don't have the wax in there, they're going to act as a channel, and they still have the wicking ability of the paper. So that's used quite a bit. And what they could also do, the paper itself, the cut of the paper, you know, how wide the channel is, that controls the wicking ability or the rate that that fluid will move through the paper. But I also saw this laminated issue. What people did is they took that paper in that realm that would have wax on it, et cetera, and then they would put it in a laminator, just like your driver license is laminated, et cetera. And you could buy that like in an office supply place. They bought this plastic laminator, and they controlled the pressure and the temperature on there. And what they were able to do is they were able to control the dynamics of that fluid channel by the lamination of that, you know, transparent material over there, some type of plastic. So I really like that this, you know, some of these areas of microfluidics, they lend themselves to the people doing this, you know, in the garage on the weekend kind of stuff, going to, you know, Costco or Best Buy and obtaining materials from, you know, Home Depot or a print shop, et cetera, and obtaining material from, you know, Sigma Aldrich or something relatively inexpensive. So these things are certainly accessible, and a lot of research could be done in this area because it's inexpensive to do. And then there's other patents in on here that you can take a look at that they did different types of polymer research. And then Whiteside, certainly one of the most famous guys in microfluidics, did a lot of research in this area. So again, you know, as we go in time, not so long ago, things kind of started, certainly started with a bang with his pregnancy test, which, you know, because of its accessibility and understandability, lent itself well to other research to be done. So we can also do color tests with these, and these are essentially like this. We can take a paper, stain area with different amounts of analyte, apply some affluent, and then look at the color changes. And they're fairly accurate. They're plottable. Sometimes they don't give you unless there's an electrical thing. If these are just based on the color, then it's rather qualitative, but we can plot that color and get some kind of scientific derivative of that. And it's a nice way of doing things. I certainly prefer myself to do things that give you a measurement with conductivity of fluid or something like that. But these are nice. And again, you can take these colors, maybe take a picture of this, and take a sample here as like a standard, you know, a standard blue. And then if your phone would happen to shift, if you're using your camera on an iPhone or something, if that color would shift because of your phone settings, we would have the standard in here, which would actually go back and be able to shift these colors so that they were as seen by the naked eye. And then we could make a relative assertion from the iPhone. It could actually apply a standard and then do some detailed analysis on there as far as the colors eliciting a certain response. So this is interesting. And certainly the ones that I like these fold-up ones and like this. They call this origami. So just like a lot of people do, they fold up paper, get a piece of paper and make a swan out of it or something like that. So I thought that was novel that people have that ability to do. So what they're able to do, just like in a modern microelectronics, we do a layering thing to make a microprocessor, et cetera, you know, maybe 100 layers to make some type of device. What they do is they just take paper, and they would print different layers on different pieces of the paper and then fold it up. And then it would be this type of system here. So they made this three-dimensional. So we can take this paper and then this paper and put them together and make a system. So I thought that was rather brilliant. And again, another way to use, another way to look at, I guess, the mechanics or the dimensionality of these types of devices. So very similar to these, you know, but these are discrete units that are placed together. I kind of like when they folded together. It was kind of, to me, a very intriguing kind of systems that they're making. So just different ways to look at the usefulness of paper to make rather complex devices. And again, these would be inexpensive and relatively easy to transport and relatively easy perhaps to get detection from. So these paper devices, they could be used for separation detection of carbohydrates, amino acids, and antibiotics. Again, this is just like the original work that was done by Charles Henry on a conventional microfluidic device, but he extended this to a paper device, and he looked at this same type of algorithm. So this is a multi-stack configuration. I think it's on the next slide. So this shows how he would measure these things. So not only could he do, this is the basic design right here of the different terminals that would make the system. Again, very small, 5 millimeters. So this on the scale of things. So the system's kind of big. So it's 2 inches by 2 inches, I guess, or something like that. You know, 2.5 centimeters being an inch. So it's around that big. So it's bigger than a postage stamp. But what it's able to do on here is he recreated this basic device in 3 different ways. So he was able to analyze one material that came in, you know, water, et cetera, or some test stream. And he was actually able to measure different types of reactions on the same chip. So while the chip is moderately big, in this example, it's doing 3 activities. And again, this is relatively inexpensive. You could print these things like these metal electrodes on here. You could take paper and with a thermal evaporator be able to deposit metals on a paper. And certainly you could stain the paper with different types of reactants. And then certainly the paper acting as a dielectric could be able to support, you know, the current voltage that you would need to do the measurement. So these are the electrodes that were shown here to do the measurement, such as applying the bias to elicit a response from the material, and then to measure that response, the change in the material as the bias is applied. So that's a really kind of cool system. Again, working back from his work in 2003, then his work was in some ways replicated in 2009 again, when the technology moved, in my impression, forward to using even more readily available and inexpensive materials such as paper-based microfluidics. There's also devices that are rather important. There's lab on a chip, so a microbiology lab. This is a device that can dissect a very small amount of DNA, proteins, or cells, or drugs. It can analyze a liquid sample 10,000 times smaller than commercial analytical instruments. So again, this lowers the cost because once you have some contaminated sample, you have to get rid of it. And it's expensive to get rid of contaminated samples. So now if we're working with smaller samples, it's less expensive to do the test. And certainly that application could apply to maybe like drug discovery. People don't have to make kilos of a new drug. They can make, you know, just grams of the drug and then test it all kind of different ways that they don't have worries about that new drug and how they're going to dispose of it. So this is a time-saving chip. Certainly these things are typically a lot faster than a conventional laboratory where we would take material in, run it through a centrifuge and all that other kind of stuff. These generally take lot less time to get a reaction. So it conserves test media and it reduces disposal issues, which is really important. So this is from Affymetrics. So right up here, if you could read that. And I'd welcome if you would look that up on the internet and do some research. They have some nice examples of lab on a chip. They have like cartoons that I didn't want to take the time to embed in the presentation here, but you should go to YouTube and look up Affymetrics and DNA lab on a chip, and they have nice cartoons in those areas that I showed you, well, such as this. This is, you know, example of that you might have a gold substrate, tether some kind of thing like a thiol, put DNA on there, and then the patient's unknown DNA could have like some kind of gold on here that might act as a plasmon, etc. Then if that would hybridize next to this area, then we would have that light on there and we would be able to say that we had a match. So we would write these areas in here, these rows and columns, we would write those with a known DNA strand. So as a researcher, I could say, well, these DNA strands represent some type of cancer or eye color or any other thing that DNA could represent. We could represent these on these columns and rows, these different locations, which might be represented as, you know, maybe some gold dot, a thiol like this, and then the known DNA that we wrote on there. And this would be half of a DNA. And that would act as a template where we would take an unknown DNA. And then we have a little nanoparticle on there that has light. We'd link that together and then it would hybridize to this area, like this dot or this dot or this dot. And then maybe this could represent prostate cancer or breast cancer or something like that, something indicative of there. And then we could do this analysis, use a CCD camera, look at it, where these, we know where these things are written, these DNA encodings, and we would say the unknown patient, where these things would land, and we could make a further determination in some type of disease, et cetera. So it's a really nice system to use, and Affymetrix is certainly one of the bigger companies that do this worldwide. So they make gene chips, they make protein chips, they make all kind of different test devices. So customers come to them, they help the customers per se with the design the chip, and then they do work together. So these microarrays work by exploiting the ability of mRNA to bind to DNA templates. So again, the DNA template is something we would write, and then that mRNA would be from the patient, which we would optically tag. And then we would look for those to go together at a certain location. And then that would prove that that material exists in our sample. So what these do, they analyze gene expressions in small membranes. They can determine expression levels of hundreds and even thousands of genes in cells by measuring the mRNA in a single experiment. So I kind of like this. And I mean, just for example, I'm not saying this does that, but we might have a gene chip like this. And this might be for both men and women. So we could express like maybe the lower part is for men. So this bottom things could be prostate cancer. And then on the top, maybe it's breast cancer for women. So this could be a universal chip. And maybe the top of it, they look at explicitly for women that would have certain diseases. And then down here, they could look at diseases that might be typical for men. So that's kind of neat that you could have one chip and maybe the functionality exceeds your needs. But then that makes that chip easier to produce in mass. And then you could use it. You don't have to stock multiple chips. You could use one chip for many, many different functions. So both men and women, and maybe even multiple attributes that you're looking for or multiple diseases. So that's a really nice use of this. And again, these things are very, very small. These chips, you can see is the scale in somebody's hand. This is the size of a postage stamp. It can be very, very powerful and do a lot of different tests for a person. So this slides into a test computer, this gene chip. We would place our material in here, have a reaction take place, and then we would place this inside, kind of like inserting a disk into a computer. And what that would do is shine light down, do an interrogation with a CCD camera, and then there's software in there that would analyze this result, and then it would output the results to the medical staff, etc. So it's a really nice system, and nice and compact, inexpensive, and it uses very little amount of material, so it's easy to dispose. And the contamination, it's hard to contaminate this because it's in a sealed system. So it's a really nice use of the technology. So why are microarrays important? They can serve a large number of genes rather quickly. They can compose and contrast cells and tissues from being healthy or diseased, and they can show how and why certain genes can or cannot work together. So they're a really powerful test device, and as you can see, probably relatively easy to produce and relatively inexpensive to produce. But certainly it's a field that's an expensive field to do that type of research, to get that to that point, to know what you're doing and how to write those or what specifically to look for on those chips. I think that's where the main crux of the money comes from, is in research. Actually, the production of the device, once you have it established and have the idea, I think that's relatively inexpensive. So this is, again, how the microarrays work. We could write our target DNA on the sample, so we would know that. For example, this could be indicative of prostate cancer. And then we would take a sample of the patient's DNA, mRNA, and what we can do is apply a restriction enzyme, cut it into little sections, apply a fluorescent label of some type. I would propose maybe a quantum dot or a plasmon. And then we would run that across the sample, and wherever it would be a good fit, because T's stick to A's and G's stick to C's, at that point, this will hybridize on the sample at that location. And then that's going to give us this, you know, signal from this optical material on there. And at that point, if it was incorrect, what we would do is probably apply a reverse bias. And that would push away stuff that wasn't strictly had the amount of bonds on there to create that bonding action. So if it was an erroneous thing, we can apply a reverse bias. And if this wasn't the exact fit to here, we can have that energy push that away and then flush the system. That way we can have a clean test. So the advantages of this, certainly it's very small. The system, disposable, sealed, portable, and a relatively fast response time. So a lot of advantages, and maybe to look at it, you know, what would be a disadvantage, it kind of puts labs out of business. Because now if you could do this, you know, if you go to the hospital and have a blood test, maybe they could have one of these microfluidic devices embedded right in the hypodermic needle. And then they plug that needle in some fashion to a computer system, and then it gives an immediate output of your blood test. So then you don't have to send it out to a lab, et cetera. So certainly that could be considered, or possibly could be less expensive to have that test. So then the test could be more widely prescribed. And then what they can do is see diseases before, predict diseases are going to happen, or when diseases just start in a person, be able to catch that right away and apply some kind of treatment before the disease gets rather costly to mitigate. So a summary of our microfluidics for today. Microfluidics is an important emerging technology that uses tools taught in the NFT program. So a lot of the things we saw, you know, our lithography work, deposition work with metals, our analysis of how to create and how to control and how to analyze nanoparticles, maybe for light emission, our look at self-assembly things for like binding thiols to gold, etc. All these tools in our tool drawer of nanotechnology we apply to microfluidics. So certainly it's a daunting thing to be able to control and make microfluidic devices. But, you know, due to education, et cetera, or maturity of the technology, a lot of these things are widely available. So those are puzzle pieces that we could use to create these devices. So key points that we have to understand for microfluidics are, you know, the role of fluidic flow. Certainly that's something that we don't see on a daily basis, that, you know, liquids don't want to mix, et cetera. So we have to take those things into consideration. The components that would be necessary for microfluidic flow, and certainly the scaling of the devices, very, very important, and what we would use, you know, what tools we would select to do the processing to actually manufacture these devices. And certainly, this is a huge area, and it's going to provide many jobs in the future. And I would see this as certainly a growing area for, medicine research on pharmaceuticals, pollution control, you know, integrity of the food stream. It's a huge area, and it's certainly going to be used more widely in the future. So it's a nice area to look at and to understand. So thanks for looking at the presentation. If you have any questions, give us a call here online, set up an arrangement, and we can have a discussion. Take care. Bye.